to Los Angeles, Monday, August 23rd, 1:04 p.m. The flight attendant poured Morton's vodka into a cut glass tumbler.
"No more ice, sweetie," Morton said, raising his hand.
They were flying west over Greenland, a vast expanse of ice and cloud in pale sun beneath them. Morton sat with Drake, who talked about how the Greenland ice cap was melting, and the rate at which the Arctic ice was melting, and the rate at which the Arctic ice was melting, and Canadian glaciers were receding. Morton sipped his vodka and nodded.
"So, Iceland is an anomaly?"
"Oh, yes," Drake said. "An anomaly. Everywhere else, glaciers are melting at an unprecedented rate."
"It's good we have you, Nick," Morton said, putting his hand on Drake's shoulder.
Drake smiled.
"And it's good we have you, George," he said. "We wouldn't be able to accomplish anything without your generous support. You've made the Vanuatu lawsuit possible, and that's extremely important for all the publicity it will generate. And as for your other grants, well, words fail me."
"Words never fail you," Morton said, slapping him on the back.
Sitting across from them, Evans thought they really were the odd couple. Morton, big and hearty, dressed casually in jeans and a work shirt, always seeming to burst from his clothes. And Nicholas Drake, tall and painfully thin, wearing a coat and tie, with his scrawny neck rising from the collar of a shirt that never seemed to fit. In their manner, too, they were complete opposites. Morton loved to be around as many people as possible, loved to eat and laugh. He had a penchant for pretty girls, vintage sports cars, Asian art, and practical jokes. His parties drew most of Hollywood to his Holmby Hills mansion. His charity functions were always special, always written up the next day. Of course, Drake attended those functions, but invariably left early, sometimes before dinner. Often he pleaded illness, his own or a friend's. In fact, Drake was a solitary, ascetic man who detested parties and noise. Even when he stood at a podium giving a speech, he conveyed an air of isolation, as if he were alone in the room. And, being Drake, he made it work for him. He managed to suggest that he was a lone messenger in the wilderness, delivering the truth the audience needed to hear. Despite their differences in temperament, the two men had built a durable friendship that had lasted the better part of a decade. Morton, the heir to a forklift fortune, had the congenital uneasiness of inherited wealth. Drake had a good use for that money, and in return provided Morton with a passion and a cause that informed and guided Morton's life. Morton's name appeared on the board of advisors of the Audubon Society, the Wilderness Society, the World Wildlife Fund, and the Sierra Club. He was a major contributor to Greenpeace and the Environmental Action League. All this culminated in two enormous gifts by Morton to NERF. The first was a grant of $1 million to finance the Vanuatu lawsuit. The second was a grant of $9 million to NERF itself to finance future research and litigation on behalf of the environment. Not surprisingly, the NERF board had voted Morton their Concerned Citizen of the Year. A banquet in his honor was scheduled for later that fall in San Francisco. Evans sat across from the two men, idly thumbing through a magazine. But he had been shaken by the Hong Kong call and found himself observing Morton with some care. Morton still had his hand on Drake's shoulder and was telling him a joke, as usual trying to get Drake to laugh. But it seemed to Evans that he detected a certain distance on Morton's part. Morton had withdrawn, but didn't want Drake to notice. This suspicion was confirmed when Morton stood up abruptly and headed for the cockpit.
"I want to know about this damn electronic thing," he said.
Since takeoff, they had been experiencing the effects of a major solar flare that rendered satellite telephones erratic or unusable. The pilots said the effect was heightened near the poles and would soon diminish as they headed south. And Morton seemed eager to make some calls. Evans wondered to whom. It was now 4 a.m. in New York, 1 a.m. in Los Angeles. Who was Morton calling? But, of course, it could concern any of his ongoing environmental projects. Water purification in Cambodia, reforestation in Guinea, habitat preservation in Madagascar, medicinal plants in Peru. To say nothing of the German expedition to measure the thickness of the ice in Antarctica. Morton was personally involved in all these projects. He knew them in detail, knew the scientists involved, had visited the locations himself. So it could be anything. But somehow, Evans felt it wasn't just anything. Morton came back.
"Pilots say it's okay now."
He sat by himself in the front of the plane, reached for his headset, and pulled the sliding door shut for privacy. Evans turned back to his magazine. Drake said,
"You think he's drinking more than usual?"
"Not really," Evans said.
"I worry."
"I wouldn't," Evans said.
"You realize," Drake said, "we are just 5 weeks from the banquet in his honor in San Francisco. That's our biggest fundraising event of the year. It will generate considerable publicity, and it'll help us launch the conference on abrupt climate change."
"Uh-huh," Evans said.
"I'd like to ensure that the publicity focuses on environmental issues and not anything else, of a personal nature, if you know what I mean."
Evans said, "Isn't this a conversation you should be having with George?"
"Oh, I have. I only mention it to you because you spend so much time with him."
"I don't, really."
"You know he likes you, Peter," Drake said. "You're the son he never had, or, hell, I don't know. But he does like you, and I'm just asking you to help us if you can."
"I don't think he'll embarrass you, Nick. Just keep an eye on him."
"Okay, sure."
At the front of the plane, the sliding door opened. Morton said,
"Mr. Evans, if you please."
Peter got up and went forward. He slid the door shut behind him.
"I have been on the phone to Sarah," Morton said.
Sarah Jones was his assistant in L.A.
"Isn't it late?" "It's her job. She's well paid. Sit down."
Evans sat in the chair opposite.
"Have you ever heard of the NSIA?
"No."
"The National Security Intelligence Agency?"
Evans shook his head.
"No, but there are 20 security agencies." "Ever heard of John Kenner?"
"No."
"Apparently he's a professor at MIT.
"No," Evans said. "Sorry. Does he have something to do with the environment?"
"He may. See what you can find out."
Evans turned to the laptop by his seat and flipped open the screen. It was connected to the internet by satellite. He started to type. In a few minutes, he was looking at a picture of a fit-looking man with prematurely gray hair and heavy horn-rimmed glasses. The attached biography was brief. Evans read it aloud. "Richard John Kenner, William T. Harding Professor of Geo-Environmental Engineering."
"Whatever that means," Morton said.
"He is 39, doctorate in civil engineering from Caltech at age 19. Did his thesis on soil erosion in Nepal. Barely missed qualifying for the Olympic ski team. A J.D. from Harvard Law School. Spent the next 4 years in government, Department of the Interior, Office of Policy Analysis, scientific advisor to the Intergovernmental Negotiating Committee. Hobby is mountain climbing. He was reported dead on Nayakonga Peak in Nepal. But he wasn't. Tried to climb K2, driven back by weather."
"K2, Morton said. "Isn't that the most dangerous peak?"
I think so. Looks like he's a serious climber. Anyway, he then went to MIT, where I'd say his rise has been spectacular. Associate professor in 93, director of the MIT Center for Risk Analysis in 95, William T. Harding professor in 96, consultant to the EPA, the Department of the Interior, the Department of Defense, the government of Nepal. God knows who else. Looks like a lot of corporations. And since 2002, on faculty leave.
Meaning what?
It just says he's on leave.
For the last 2 years?
Morton came and looked over Evans' shoulder.
I don't like it. The guy burns up the track at MIT, goes on leave, and never comes back. You think he got into trouble?
I don't know, but Evans was calculating the dates. Professor Kenner got a doctorate from Caltech at 19, got his law degree from Harvard in 2 years instead of three, professor at MIT when he's 28.
Okay, so he's smart, Morton said. I still want to know why he's on leave and why he's in Vancouver.
Evans said, he's in Vancouver?
He's been calling Sarah from Vancouver.
Why?
He wants to meet with me.
Well, Evans said, I guess you better meet with him.
I will, Morton said. But what do you think he wants?
I have no idea. Funding? A project?
Sarah says he wants the meeting to be confidential. He doesn't want anybody to be told.
Well, that's not hard. You're on an airplane.
No, Morton said, jerking his thumb. He specifically doesn't want Drake to be told.
Maybe I'd better attend this meeting, Evans said.
Yes, Morton said. Maybe you should.
Los Angeles, Monday, August 23rd, 4:09 p.m. The iron gate swung open, and the car drove up the shaded driveway to the house that slowly came into view. This was Holmby Hills, the wealthiest area of Beverly Hills. The billionaires lived here, in residences hidden from the street by high gates and dense foliage. In this part of town, security cameras were all painted green and tucked back unobtrusively. The house came into view. It was a Mediterranean-style villa, cream-colored and large enough for a family of 10. Evans, who had been speaking to his office, flipped his cell phone shut and got out as the car came to a stop. Birds chirped in the ficus trees. The air smelled of the gardenia and jasmine that bordered the driveway. A hummingbird hung near the purple bougainvillea at the garage. It was, Evans thought, a typical California moment. Evans had been raised in Connecticut and schooled in Boston. Even after 5 years in California, the place still seemed exotic to him. He saw that another car was parked in front of the house, a dark gray sedan. It had government license plates. From out of the front door came Morton's assistant, Sarah Jones, a tall blonde woman of 30, as glamorous as any movie star. Sarah was dressed in a white tennis skirt and pink top, her hair pulled back in a ponytail. Morton kissed her lightly on the cheek.
You playing today?
I was. My boss came back early.
She shook Evans's hand and turned back to Morton.
Good trip?
Fine. Drake is morose, and he won't drink. It gets tiresome.
As Morton started toward the door, Sarah said,
I think I ought to tell you they're here right now.
Who is?
Professor Kenner, and another guy with him, foreign guy.
Really? But didn't you tell them they had to...
Make an appointment? Yes, I did. They seem to think that doesn't apply to them. They just sat down and said they'd wait.
You should have called me.
They got here 5 minutes ago.
Huh. Okay. He turned to Evans. Let's go, Peter.
They went inside. Morton's living room looked out on the garden in back of the house. The room was decorated with Asian antiques, including a large stone head from Cambodia. Sitting erectly on the couch were two men. One was an American of middle height, with short gray hair and glasses. The other was very dark, compact, and very handsome, despite the thin scar that ran down the left side of his face in front of his ear. They were dressed in cotton slacks and lightweight sport coats. Both men sat on the edge of the couch, very alert, as if they might spring up at any moment.
"Look military, don't they?" Morton muttered as they went into the room.
The two men stood.
"Mr. Morton, I'm John Kenner from MIT, and this is my colleague Sanjiang, a graduate student from Mustang in Nepal."
Morton said,
"And this is my colleague, Peter Evans."
They shook hands all around. Kenner's grip was firm. Sanjiang gave a very slight bow as he shook hands. He spoke softly, with a British accent. "How do you do?"
"I didn't expect you," Morton said. "So soon."
"We work quickly."
"So I see. What's this about?"
"I'm afraid we need your help, Mr. Morton." Kenner smiled pleasantly at Evans and Sarah. "And unfortunately, our discussion is confidential."
"Mr. Evans is my attorney," Morton said. "And I have no secrets from my assistant."
"I'm sure," Kenner said. "You may take them into your confidence whenever you choose, but we must speak to you alone." Evans said, "If you don't mind, I'd like to see some identification."
"Of course," Kenner said.
Both men reached for wallets. Evans was shown Massachusetts driver's licenses, MIT faculty cards, and passports. Then they handed out business cards. John Kenner, Ph.D., Center for Risk Analysis, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, 454 Massachusetts Avenue, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02138. Sanjiang, Ph.D., Research Associate, Department of Geoenvironmental Engineering, Building 4-C-323, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02138. There were telephone numbers, fax, email. Evans turned the cards over. It all looked straightforward. Kenner said,
"Now, if you and Miss Jones will excuse us..."